Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefeo on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. And for more alternative media, go to thecommonsprojectnetwork.com.
Stuart Alexander. Once again, I would like to welcome our listeners to the Socialist Insight. Today we have Stephen Katz. He's been on our program from time to time, and we're going to be discussing a very interesting topic with Stephen Katz. I might mention that Stephen is the state chair for the Socialist Party USA there in New York. And Stephen, once again, I'd like to welcome you to the program.
It's always a pleasure. It's always a stimulating discussion.
Stephen, we have a very interesting topic that we are going to be discussing today, and a little bit challenging, and I know there's going to be a lot of pros and cons on both sides of this issue. And what we're going to be discussing is left unity possible? So we're discussing left unity in general between left organizations, and just want to know, is it possible? In my opinion, it seems like it's probably at least 100 years away, but that's the subject that we're going to be discussing today. And Stephen, I would just like to begin our discussion today. Where do you start in an effort to unify the left, considering that the left is all over the place?
Well, the task of overcoming capitalism and creating a socialist society needs a protracted struggle. It's breathtakingly complex. It will take generations, if not centuries, as it has in the past. And it's absolutely necessary that we unify as much as possible. Now, the left is always been plagued, and I suppose all political movements, and indeed other types of movements, religious, scientific, and social, are plagued by splits. Now, almost from the beginning in the First International, which had none other than Karl Marx behind it, you already had a split between the followers of Marx and scientific socialism and the anarchists led by Bakunin and the utopians led by Proudhon of France. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's always been a struggle there, and, you know, there's always different ways of going about it. In fact, Marx, in order to shape Bakunin's influence, who Bakunin had a very powerful influence, and he was also a very charismatic and a huge presence and equal to Marx in force of personality, which is saying something because Marx was an extremely dominant individual. And Marx had the First International moved over here to New York City. In fact, this weekend the Socialist Party convention is here, and we're going to take some of the comrades down to show them the location of where the First International, the building is still standing, incidentally, in lower Manhattan. But it's more necessary than ever, I think, and we should learn from our history. And where there are splits, there's weakness. And we know the capitalists, you know, one of their favorite tactics to break unions is to set one group of the workforce against the other, try to have, it's the old divide and conquer strategy. We don't need to do that to ourselves.
Well, you know, when I ask you where do we start, and much of what I'm looking at is that if you look in the last few years when we have had all the more reason to be ready to unite, and then I see what has taken place just within the last two elections in 2008 and 2008, many of the political parties and groups on the left, they supported the Democrats in elections such as, in, as I mentioned, 2008 and 2012.
Right.
And they were strong supporters of Obama.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're talking about supporting the either one of the two capitalist parties, how can you even talk about, you know, being ready to unite behind left issues when you're supporting the Democrats? So where do we start when we're talking about we have the left movement, socialists, and even communists that are endorsing persons such as Barack Obama? Where do you start? Because that seemed like it's the wrong direction.
Well, I mean, it's definitely the wrong direction, you know, at this point in history. And I think that Obama, I view as a special case because, you know, he's our first black president, and he's also, he was a union organizer, and I think a lot of people were pulled in by that whole narrative. Now, he may have been, in some instances, well-intentioned, but, you know, once he got in there, he became a total captive of the capitalist forces, and in order to get in there, he had to do that bidding from day one. But there is a, I think these past 8 years have opened people's eyes, and it's an educational process as well. But there is, has been a movement recently in the past few years on the more organized left and the more conscious left to come together. For instance, the committees for the committees of correspondence for democratic socialism, which is which came out of the Communist Party, has been trying to forge something. I think. They have some kind of alliance with the Freedom Socialist Party and some kind of alliance with the Democratic Socialists of America. And I've been trying to get the Socialist Party USA moving in the direction so that we can also join that coalition. Now, within our own party, of course, there are various opinions, but we have always been against the Leninist model of libertarian or a centralized socialist movement. We've always been much more libertarian, and that goes way back to the beginning, almost when our party did not join in the Third International. We were a part of the Second International, and I think we were the only socialist party other than the Bolsheviks not to have endorsed World War One. All of the other so-called leftist parties in their countries endorsed their own countries in the war, and to the credit of Eugene Debs, as well as Lenin, you know, we were one of two formations that did not join in that.
Mm-hmm.
So now our party is more accepting of the democratic socialists. In other words, there is much more desire to unify with, let's say, the Democratic Socialists of America or with CCDS, and less of a desire to unify with parties who at least ostensibly are Marxist-Leninists or mainly Leninists. And my own opinion, although I support that as a general policy, I think we have to make strategic alliances. We don't have to agree theoretically, but I think strategic alliances all along the line are very important. And
now,
to
explain
me,
what you mean when you say strategic alliances.
Well,
what are you referring to?
Well, I mean, there's a whole bunch of parties. Now, the CP we know has been behind Obama. Now, the CP has been supporting the Democratic Party since, I think, in the early 70s. But there are other parties.
You said the Communist Party was behind starting in the 70s, they were supporting Democratic candidates. Yeah. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it seems to be, you know, from what I understand, maybe it started.
Did they support Jimmy Carter?
I'm not sure about Carter, but I know
because he was the only Democratic candidate in, the Democratic president that actually held office, but other than that, it was no other Democratic presidents. So, but you're saying they were, the Communist Party were supporting Democratic candidates, is that what you're saying?
Candidates, yes, candidates.
Oh, okay, I see.
Yeah, not so much. Well, I mean, with Obama, he was actually elected on the heels of the financial collapse. But, I mean, now there are other parties. There's the RCP, the Revolutionary Communist Party. There's Workers' World Party. There's all kinds of Trotskyist sects and groups. And my own personal opinion, is we don't have to theoretically agree with them, but we can join in strategic alliances when it comes to anti-war actions, when it comes to fighting for raising the minimum wage, and so on and so forth. I've always said that, you know, it's healthy to have different tendencies. Once we effectuate a revolution, however we do it and then whatever it looks like, then the various tendencies can fight it out and we can see what works best. But we have such an enormous force against us that it seems to me to be the height of folly to be sniping at each other and to be petty about it.
Those forces, I mean, we're talking about the forces of Wall Street. We're talking about the forces of their functionaries that are those that are there in Congress. They're working for Wall Street. They control all the entire monetary system of the country, and they control all the laws. I mean, we're as far as you can get away from a democracy these days. So those are the forces that people need to understand. We're fighting that, so there's no room for us to fight each other.
No, there isn't. And like I said, there are kinds of early signs of this. There's still people in all these parties and tendencies that are still fighting battles that were fought 70, 80, and even 100 years ago. And these ideological battles, while they have significance for the people involved in them, most of the younger generation coming up couldn't care less about them. They're concerned about crushing debt, no jobs. And I would point out, we're in a unique position to revitalize socialism right now because the latest polls taken show that the youth under 29 has a more favorable opinion, a somewhat more favorable opinion, of socialism than capitalism. And that's the first time that's happened in many, many years. I don't know if they
even took polls. Has been in almost 80 years.
Yeah, I mean,
and they weren't doing polls then, but this is the highest it's ever been, at least in the within the last 50 years. But they have been looking at people's views and opinions towards socialism, even coming out of the 30s. And people, there's a tremendous leaning now towards socialism. And we're going to get into that later on during our program today, where we're going to be discussing why a growing number of young people are now having a favorable view of socialism.
Right.
You know, back to what I was saying in regards to political parties and the last election, we still have this tendency of we need to support the Democrats because they're the lesser of the two evils, rather than understand that we're looking at, you know, it's one party with two faces, but it's basically the same party. And the Democrats and the Republicans and the capitalists have used the nature of that political makeup that they have between the Democrats and the Republicans even to divide the left, where people think that the Democrats are the ones that we need to support. But the Democrats are no better than the Republicans.
Well, I mean, that's true because, you know, you have corporate, financial, and military-industrial control of both parties. It may be more complete in the Republican Party, but it's over time it has overtaken the Democratic Party tremendously. And, you know, so, I mean, the only difference there may be that the Democrats are more inclined to try to reform capitalism around the edges and to moderate the modify the most egregious aspects of it. And of course we know that, you know, it's a bromide and it's a placebo and it's not getting at the fundamental disease. And you have less and less people going in that direction. So, I mean, but, you know, it's an educational process.
Now, many groups on the left, you know, and I'm talking about left political parties, right. You know, we have more than our fair share of problems, but and when I'm saying problems, these are problems with that are outside of the organizations that we're in. But, Stephen, there's what I see is the internal struggle that we have among members within these organizations. And I'm talking about even the organization that you and myself are a member of, the
right.
Socialist Party USA. I look at the last election that we had, the last nominations that we had in 2011, where I was nominated as the presidential candidate for the party. But
right.
you had such a, you know, the factions that were within that room that they couldn't even sensibly agree on candidates. They couldn't agree on procedures. They couldn't agree on anything. And then it just came down to, we just don't want to support the candidate because the candidate represents your side. You know, and
right.
it wasn't, you know, like I said, it wasn't based on fact or issues. It was just based on you're supporting that candidate, so we don't want to support him. But it's not just this party, but it's other groups, such as, you know, in PSL, the Party for Socialism and Liberation. You have the same thing in the, you know, in the Freedom Socialist Party. You have it in the Workers' Party, Socialist Workers' Party. You have it in every party. But there's such an internal struggle that's going on even within our parties. And Stephen, you have seen that in our own party. Could you speak on that?
True. But in the final analysis, when you have a democratic open party, I'm not talking about democratic centralism, but when you have a democratic socialist party, you're going to have a lot more contention than if you have some kind of authoritarian leader and a small central committee laying down the line. So that's one thing. And our party has, you know, like any party, it has different factions in it. And,
right.
But, you know, I see a divide amongst the younger and the older comrades. And I think the younger comrades they're more action issue oriented and they're less concerned about ideological disputes. Now, as far as candidates go, not every party nominates them anymore. The Communist Party used to have candidates, but they abandoned that many years ago.
They endorse candidates.
Yeah, they endorse. And, well, I noticed the Socialist Workers Party had a candidate for mayor out there this year. The only official socialist on the ballot, but and some don't believe in elections. The Revolutionary
right.
Communist Party, which is headed up by Bob Avakian and a small central committee, they think participating in elections is legitimizing the system and uses up a lot of energies that should be used in a more revolutionary fashion outside the system, with demonstrations and street actions and so on and so forth. But you notice there that, you know, they have a central committee and they have the chairman there, Bob Avakian. He's been chairman for decades. You know, that's what you have. You know, it's like Chairman Mao or, you know, Stalin or, you know, whatever it is. You know, you have the paramount leader, and then it almost goes into a cult.
Right.
So, of course, you have less. Go ahead.
Now, one of the things what you're referring to right now, one of the things I see within many of these organizations, many of the members, especially the old guard within these organizations, they are very opposed to leadership. And Stephen, I have to say, I even see that in the Socialist Party USA. I mean, when you talk about someone that could speak, you know, nationally or internationally, be a spokesperson for the organization, you can still sense that, you know, that element that we don't want to have a leader or director or a president of the organization, you know, because it's that objection to leadership. And it was just something I brought up. It was almost eight months, maybe a year ago, but there was a strong objection when I said, well, we need to have a national spokesperson for the party. Let's face it. I mean, you have Rens Priebus with the Republican Party. You have Debbie with the Democratic Party. You have them as national spokespersons for those organizations. Why? We don't have any national spokespersons for the party. Sure, we have a national chair and co-chairs, but we don't have anyone that's a national spokesperson for the organization. But not just the Socialist Party USA, but I see this with many of the Socialist Parties out there, and even the Communist Parties, that they don't have national spokespersons, which sort of brings us to that point that there's an objection to leadership. And I might even go even further. Many people object to even being organized.
Well, I mean, you know, this is something of which I myself have learned over long periods of time. In order to accomplish anything in society, and particularly in politics, society in general, you need good organization and you do need leadership. Now, there's a difference between what I call natural functional leadership and authoritarian leadership.
Right.
Now, like with Avakian, who, you know, is a pretty good analyst of capitalism. If you read his stuff, it's very interesting. But organizationally speaking, he's become a cult. And, you know, that's just one person, and it gets very authoritarian. And and no matter how brilliant an individual may be or no matter how articulate, you know, you want to have more than one spokesman, but you do want to have a situation where you do have leadership. Now, there's natural leadership where those who have more experience and more knowledge will take more leadership positions, and as the younger and, you know, age might not necessarily be the indicator. You might have younger comrades who have that as well, but that's really, you know, what we should be aiming for. But those organizations that completely negate leadership, like anarchist organizations that, you know, I mean, where is Occupy today? Occupy had a lot of good aspects to it, but it was built on a very libertarian, anarchist basis, and, you know, it was very easy to break up and dissipate, you know, because there's no ongoing, although they have tried to maintain some presence, there's no ongoing structure there.
Could you explain to our listeners what, when you say anarchist, what are you referring to?
Well,
explain that
I
to our listeners.
The anarchists, going back into the 19th century, they were socialists, but they were very anti-state. And they believed that right after the revolution, people could come into full revolutionary freedom without the necessity of any state structures, and they've always been very anti-authoritarian, anti-leadership.
Right.
But in point of fact is
now the reason I want you to get back to explaining, you know, when you say anarchist, so people can understand that. If you say anti, and the main thing you said was anti leadership. anti-state, anti-government, anti-structure.
Right.
How are you going to have unity with people that are anarchists?
Well, typically the anarchists, if you really go to the pure anarchism, what you would have is cells or affinity groups, you know, that would carry out certain actions, and then they would dissipate, they would regroup, you know. They did not build any enduring structures, and some of them are very brilliant individuals, and they fought very hard. And, you know, I could think going back in our own country, we had Emma Goldman, who, you know, was a tremendous anti-war activist in World War I, and, you know, was a tremendous pro-labor activist. She was very much against any kind of labor union because she felt the labor unions only tied the workers up. And, you know, but I think Marx had a much more historically grounded understanding that you just can't leap to freedom immediately. You need transitional structures. You do need leadership, and particularly with the very complex societies we have today. I mean, we need a transitional socialist state. Now, as far as the parties are concerned, you know, if you don't have a good organization and you don't have spokespeople, it doesn't necessarily have to be one. It could be a group of people. It gets harder for you to get your message out, and it gets harder for you to be effective. If you want to run a candidate, if you want to participate in a coalition, whether it's to raise the minimum wage or against these continuing imperialist wars. I was, for a time, I used to attend an organization many years ago called News and Letters, which was created by Raya Dunyevskaya, who came out of the Trotskyist movement, and they were completely against any type of structure whatsoever. They had
right.
some committees around the country, and, you know, they were completely against any type of not only democratic centralism, but even the concept of a party was, you know, almost anarchist, but still trying to adhere to a Marxist, Trotskyist type of approach. And they have had virtually zero effect on anybody or anything. And eventually, there was a group in New York, and I used to attend meetings from time to time. That group split up, and now, you know, there's one group with two people in it, and every year or two they get a third for a year, and that's it. I mean, there's no organization anymore.
Right.
Or it's all fragmented in different little spots, and, you know, that's not the way to go. I mean, of course, the old...
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
The ultimate idea would be a mass party of working people and poor people, immigrants, so on and so forth, both to elect people to make the transition and to create a socialist state and to have an upsurge, a mass movement in the streets. I mean, that is what is really needed. And I think that it adheres much more closely to what socialism requires, and the various parties can be catalysts in that. That's the way I see it. But, you know, a catalyst has to have a structure. If you have a
right.
chemical reaction with a catalyst, the catalyst does have a structure. It affects other things and transforms them, helps transform them. And that's
right.
really
mm-hmm.
the original concept of a socialist party or a communist party, is that you had the most advanced workers would get together and help organize the other people to overthrow the capitalist system and institute a socialist society. So that's why I
yeah.
think,
yeah. yeah.
That's why
think,
I think
right?
that we need, well, we need our alliances and coalitions and, you know, to go after these various problems and to take on the very complicated and protracted struggle of transforming and overthrowing capitalism and creating a socialist state. We have to use that together. And then, in a scientific, philosophically rigorous approach, in post-revolutionary society,
right,
you will test out various different approaches, and those that don't work will very readily and very apparently become obvious. And if the power remains in the masses of people, no small group, be they, you know, Bolsheviks, Maoists, or Trotskyists, will be able to enforce their particular conceptions on the masses of people.
Well,
so
one of the things,
one
of the things what I'm looking at, and I don't see anything where they're going to be forced out of power by any left groups, because both groups, the Democrats and Republicans, seem like they don't self-destruct anyway. Their ratings in the public is now below 10% and has remained there for months. And they can't, well, it appears that they can't agree on anything, but what they do agree on is what comes, the edicts that come out of Wall Street saying this is what we want, and that's what they do. But I want to ask you in regards to the Democrats, you know, and some people on the left, you know, they consider the Democrats left and they consider the Republicans right. But
right.
I want to ask you, was the Democratic Party ever, ever a left party?
I would say that I think when FDR was in, that was as far left as it ever went. But even then you had a problem because you had the Dixiecrats. And the Dixiecrats were Southern racists.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so there were certain areas that the Democratic leadership couldn't go into. Or found it more difficult to go into. But I would think the height of any form of leftism came with FDR. And he was able to do it because of the severe crisis, and it was a different circumstance than it is today. But even there, you couldn't characterize the party as a whole as being left. You know, did have some people with a more left philosophy in the leadership at that time. And, you know, you might say that Lyndon Johnson in some of his domestic programs was left-leaning. But the party
thing
as a whole,
You know, what I find interesting is how what was happening in the 30s, how the Democrats basically, they were, the socialist movement was actually many of the things that came out of the legislation in the 30s, it was a result of the socialists, and the means by which they were able to get out their views and opinions that influenced the politics of the day was through the Democratic Party. And now we see the same thing happening in our own, in this most recent decade, the same thing that happened 70 years ago. Do you see the similarities yourself, Stephen?
Well, I mean, I don't see...
I mean, I could be wrong, but I just want to get your opinion on that.
My feeling is that, and it's quite true, that a lot of the programs that were advocated, for instance, by Norma Thomas and also Eugene Debs, but in particular Norman Thomas also...
Because
he was around, he was our presidential candidate in for a long time in the 20s, 30s, and 40s.
In 30s and 40s.
He advocated things like unemployment insurance and all that kind of stuff. And some of that was picked up by the Democrats. I don't see that happening today. I don't see the Democrats as advocating for what is really
necessary. Oh, they're not today.
No,
what I'm
not
saying
today.
What I'm saying is, you know, and I might mention when you see what's going on today, that Democrats, like the Republicans, are going on the attack against many of these social programs, such
right.
as Medicare and various things that will help needy families, things that will help the homeless. The Democrats are side by side with the Republicans. Let's make cuts, and more money for the military. We're a little over halfway through our program. We have Stephen Katz joining us today. He's with the Socialist Party USA. He is the state chair for the New York chapter of the Socialist Party. And again, we'd like to welcome you to the program today, Stephen.
Thank you.
Stephen, we're going to get into the second part of this program because the issue in regards to students and many of the young people, they're starting to have a greater interest in socialism and the socialist movement. But the last thing I want to speak on this this topic that we were dealing with, left unity, is it possible? And then I'd like for you to have just a couple last words on that. Stephen, there are hundreds of left groups out there, hundreds. I mean, when you go down the list, it's the ones that people are more familiar with would be the Green Party, the Justice Party, the Socialist
right.
Party of America, the Socialist Party USA, Peace and Freedom Party, Party for Socialism and Liberation, Socialist Equality Party, Working Families Party. I mean, the list goes on. And Steve, I haven't even touched the tip of the iceberg. I can go on for another 10 minutes just talking about the list of parties. Those are the ones that are more that people are more familiar with.
Right.
Where do you start with the small group in regards to group of parties to start to form a coalition, or do you start trying to create a unifying platform like the New Progressive Alliance, what they're doing, and Alan Mackey trying to form a coalition among many organizations? Where do you start? Do you start big or do you start small?
I think you got to start small. I think you got to go with coalitions. I don't think you can merge or agree on common platforms. There's too many theoretical differences. But the way to go about it would be to build trust among the groups by sitting down and planning and participating in common events, whether it's May Day, whether it's a demonstration to raise the minimum wage, whether it's a demonstration to support striking workers, whether it's anti-war demonstrations, teach-ins, education on imperialism. And then as the trust is built up, then you can form more and more coalitions and get more and more of the multitudes of people involved and act as a catalyst and see where that goes rather than attempt to do any sort of merger. And it seems to have worked on to a very limited extent with the committees on correspondence for democratic socialism. They seem to have, with a few groups, they seem to have gotten together and they got some unions to march in May Day in Manhattan, which didn't happen for many years. Since the McCarthy era, the unions were frightened stiff to be associated with May Day.
Uh-huh.
So, that's the way they've been doing it, and I think the movement as a whole be well advised to go in that direction towards creating a mass party, and we'll never do it through the electoral system because it's controlled more and more by big money, and, the Supreme Court and Citizens United made sure that was exponentially made even more so. And, but it is good to get people elected wherever you can as tribunes of the people, to use an old phrase, and the most feasible place would be on city and town councils, school boards, and state legislatures, and in the history of the Socialist Party, we've had that. And I think that really is the way to go. And we have to get off these 100-year-old debates, that took place between, the Kautskyites and the Leninists and, all this other stuff.
Tell me about it.
Yeah, which is, which is not of interest to anybody, but, and I'm not saying that you should learn from history. But for crying out loud, I mean, let's not use up our time and energy arguing something that was argued 100 years ago.
I definitely agree with you. Inevitably, I go to a meeting just to visit a group and just to sit in. And then someone, after the meeting, they want to start debating all of my philosophical views on everything. And it's like, you know, I thought that was already talked out 100 years ago, and they want to engage in, you know, some mindless debates, and I just try to stay away from that. Stephen, we're going to get in the last part of our program today about young people having a more favorable view of socialism. And, Stephen, there's many reasons why we see that, you know, students in particular, but young people to have a more favorable view of socialism. Why do you think that that is happening now? Because I remember if I go back just 30 years ago, it was less than 20% of the people that even had an interest in socialism, young people and working people as a whole. Now when you look at the age group in the late teens and into their 30s, Stephen, I mean, the numbers have more than doubled. I mean, they're now in the 40 percentile range, almost
right.
49, I think 48, 49%. What is causing this, in your opinion? Which is a good thing.
Yeah, no, it's a good thing, but normally what happens is when there's some type of systemic crisis, and we had it in the 60s with civil rights and the Vietnam War movement, you had a whole renaissance in that period of people going back into the socialist analysis to try to understand what was going on. Now, in the present day, there's a systemic economic crisis going on, and, you know, there are no jobs for young people coming out of school. They're burdened with tremendous debt, and all of this because of a rapacious, predatory capitalist system that made money off of them when they were in school, that makes money off of them by giving them student loans, and doesn't want to hire them because
right.
it infringes on the profitability of their particular enterprise, and they'd rather use the money to speculate on foreign stock exchanges and to buy assets and all other kinds of things. So, you know, and that was a big impetus behind Occupy, because when I was down at Occupy, the one here in Zuccotti Park, a lot of the people I met there, were, particularly the young people, were unemployed. And they were very frustrated, but they found Occupy gave them an outlet to use their talents. And they were very talented young people and who had a lot to offer and a lot to contribute. But capitalist society didn't have any use for them because they couldn't make an immediate profit off of them, given
right.
the current systemic collapse. And that forces or compels or motivates people, particularly the younger people who are, and working people who are getting hit hard, to try to look deeper than the surface. Because it seems to be part of human nature that the more comfortable you are, the less likely you are to look underneath the rug, so to speak. As my father used
right.
to say to me, he used to say, "Stephen, why do you always have to look under the rug, you know?
Right.
Why can't you just leave it there, you know? Why do you have to always go under the rug?" Well, but these circumstances force you to look under the rug. And, you know, and I said, well, look, you know, all my buddies are being drafted and killed. Of course I'm looking under the rug. I'm looking every place to try to get
right.
an answer as to what the hell is going on.
Right. Well, some of the things that we can look at, Stephen, as you mentioned about student debt, $1.2
right.
trillion dollars. 1.2. I mean, that's, you know, that's a good reason why people start losing interest in the system of capitalism. It's not working. I was just speaking with the RN just yesterday, and she just recently got her first job after getting out of school. But she was saying her student loan debts, you know, to pay those off, she says it's going to be approximately 20 years. And last week I was speaking with my dentist, and he was saying he was trying to get into a home, but his loan was turned down because of his $380,000 loan debt that he had to become a dentist. $380,000. I say, how long is it going to take you to pay that off? He said, it's probably going to take me at least 25 years to pay it off. But, Steve, we see this everywhere, where students are going to college and then they can't get jobs. So that in itself is very compelling. Why would you believe in a system that lets you down like that? You agree?
Absolutely. I mean, it's irrational, and it's all because of the relentless, unmitigated drive for profit, regardless of the destructiveness that is being done. I mean, education, including higher education and postgraduate education, all of that, the society has the wealth to fund all of that at a much lesser level and, you know, to make it close to where students might just have to, you know, buy their books and some of their accoutrements and some of their living expenses, but not the main cost of the education. And, I mean, Cuba has a system like that. The Soviet Union had a system like that. China used to. They don't have it anymore because of China's become state capitalist. But, I mean, even to this day, the Cuban, the medical school down in Havana will take even Americans from poor communities if they make a pledge to go back and practice medicine in that community. And they get a full scholarship down there. I mean, I think they probably only have to buy their books or whatever, you know. And, you know, and Cuba is, I don't have to say, Cuba is a society with much less resources than the United States.
Oh,
far less. At least. And, you know, so it's all possible. If the capitalists weren't, you know, using trillions to fund their wars to seize oil fields and to exploit people overseas, if all that money could come back here and be used for education and health and all of that, we would have a system which would be much, much more life friendly and life enhancing than the one we have now, which I remember something that Marx said in one of his volumes of Capital. He says the capitalists have a werewolf hunger for profit. And, you know, that's just what it is. It's ferocious. And you know,
and the other thing that people must focus on is when they look at jobs, that most of the jobs that are being created today are minimum wage jobs. That's the highest sector of jobs that are being created. Over capitalism when you're looking at minimum wage jobs? I see here in California, people don't even want to apply for the jobs for $8.50 or $9 an hour because they start thinking, well, how am I going to pay for my bills, let alone pay to take care of the needs of a family?
Yeah, and there's a big movement now among fast food workers to try to go against that. And, of course, the resistance from the capitalists is ferocious against raising that. But, you know, even the jobs that are going to people who have gone through college now, the wages for everybody and salaries has gone way down since the crash. And that's one of the things they're using, you know, to pump up their profitability. You know, the hourly wages have gone down drastically. So young people are faced, and all of us to some extent are faced, with working for much less. But the young people in particular are faced with these huge, crushing burdens of debt and jobs that don't even give them enough money or barely give them enough money to pay off some of the interest, let alone the principals of these loans, and some of them can't. And the law has been changed to make it impossible for them to discharge these debts in bankruptcy.
They can't discharge the debt.
So in a way, it's kind of like, see, what the capitalists are doing is they're pushing everything back to the 19th century. They want to destroy all of the social gains that were fought for on the part of working people throughout the 20th century. They want to go back into the 19th century.
And I want people to understand what you're saying when you say push those gains back to the 19th century. We're talking about pushing it well over 125 years of pushback. So that's what we're talking about. They want to push it back into the 1800s, and that's where we're going.
Well, it's exactly where we're going. There's almost no enforcement of Fair Labor Standards Acts, either by
none.
State or federal. People are being forced to work all kinds of hours without overtime pay. you know, there's increasing use of temporary workers with no health insurance, no benefits, except, you know, very marginal. And I don't think this Obamacare is going to do all that much about it, because unless they can provide enough money to subsidize people, because, you know, I was reading some history this week.
Uh-huh.
Way back in the middle of the 19th century in France, they were already protesting the use of temporary workers in certain industries. Because even then, and we're going back now 150 years, the workers knew that it was a threat to everything, and it's ideal. What better thing for the capitalists to have what Marx called the Industrial Reserve Army, a whole bunch
right.
of people who are going to sit around and starve until they're needed. You hire them when you need them, and when
right,
you don't,
exactly.
when you can get away with not using them, you just dismiss them, no strings attached. That's what they've been trying to move towards in Europe when they say they want to change the labor standards. They want to drive it all down. And, you know, talking about left unity, we need left unity internationally. And this is another thing that they knew in the 19th century, because we have workers being pitted against each other, Chinese workers against U.S. workers, against Indonesian workers, against Vietnam workers. We need an international movement of worker solidarity, so the workers here are not being pitted against workers in other countries, and so everybody on this planet can get a job and can work, and it's not a zero-sum game where if one person is working, it has to throw another person out of work.
Now, when we say young people having a favorable view of socialism, one of the things that can cause you to have a favorable view of socialism is when you're still having to live at home with your parents. We find that more young people, whether they graduate from high school or college, or even when they get married, still having to live at home with their parents. Because
I know that.
Because
I know
they can't find a job for me. What was that again, Stephen?
I said, you know, that's another aspect of it, and it's during this time of financial collapse and systemic crisis that we've had, and there still is an employment crisis going on. The whole families have moved back in it's like this happened a lot during the Depression, where younger families would move in with the grandparents. You know,
right.
And they would all pool whatever money they had, and they would have a roof over their heads. And, you know, just in my own small family, my niece and her boyfriend, who were recently married, but for the past year or so, they've been living with my brother-in-law and with my sister, because the guy just couldn't find a job, and the jobs that he did get were really terrible jobs that he couldn't hold on to.
And, Stephen, one of the other things I can see that would be driving people towards socialism, they can see that the capitalists are just continuously going into one war after another war. And we can see a lot of this through the social media. One of the things I was impressed with just recently is when Obama and his administration and Congress wanted to march into another war with Syria, the whole nation saw it on the Internet. The Internet just lit up, and the whole world was saying, you know, we don't want this war. But people are seeing the same thing that we saw back in the 60s and the early 70s, where they see that the capitalists for profit and gain, they go from one war to another, and people are just saying that we are fed up with wars. But this is one of the a good example of why many people, in my opinion, are saying, you know, they're just fed up with capitalism, is because the capitalists continuously go into one war after another just for profit, and it's done on the backs of our young people, our kids, and our families. It's our blood, and it's their profits.
That's why it's important to educate, starting, you know, at a high school level, so that, and youth organizations are very important, so that the kids can resist these blandishments where they can't find jobs here and they're promised all kinds of things if they join the Army and all of this kind of stuff. You know, and this, of course, you know, capitalism entered the domain of imperialism about 100 years ago because it can't stay within its national borders. It has to internationalize in order to keep the pursuit of profit going. Otherwise, Otherwise, the contradictions will come down, and then you get, you know, rival imperialisms, and this time there was a tremendous upsurge, and you know, people were calling into Congress, and you know, there was a tremendous upsurge to stop the Syrian thing, and I'm sure that definitely had an effect. But it also had an effect that the Russians, you know, started drawing lines, and they said, you know, let's try
and
to,
the Chinese.
You know, and the Chinese, they were saying, look, let's try to stop these constant things, constant wars, and try to get more of a diplomatic solution because it was starting to encroach on their own interests.
The Russians and the Chinese were basically saying, you know, let's take a different approach and stop using all the lies to go into another war.
Exactly, exactly. So all of that put a check on them, at least temporarily, put a check on the capitalist imperialists to try to keep them, you know, to try to tamp this down. And, you know, it was a good turn of events. At the moment, we still don't know what's going on.
Well, the good news is a lot of young people are starting to see socialism very favorably, and they're starting to realize that that's a better system for working people. We have two more minutes, Stephen. I want you to get contact information, and I want you to take around 30 seconds just to announce a very important convention that I'll be attending myself, the Socialist Party's National Convention there in New York. Could you just do an announcement, and we're going to wrap the show up for today.
Yeah, I look forward to seeing you there, Stuart. Yes, there's going to be a national convention in New York City this weekend, this coming weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday in Long Island City. And anyone listening can learn about that by going on the website, the Socialist Party USA. Just Google that. And there's all kinds of information, membership information, and so on and so forth. And if you join and become a member, you can attend, but you can become a member anyway. Anybody who wants to get in touch with me or the party can write to the Socialist Party USA, 339 Lafayette Street, number 303, New York, New York, 112. Also, the website will give you a list of locals throughout the country where you can see if there's a local in your city or town. If there isn't, you can create one.
And again, Stephen, I will be looking forward to seeing you this weekend. And I'd like to thank our listeners once again for joining the Socialist Party, for joining the Socialist Insight. And again, Stephen, I would like to extend my appreciation for you joining as our guest today. We look forward to having you to join us next week on the Socialist Insight. Thanks again.
Thank you,
Ruth Ann.
Thanks, Stuart. Thank you.
My pleasure. Good night.
Good night, Ruth.
Good night.